Welcome to Season 5, Episode 8 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we debate, can you have too many gaming accessories? We ponder, how difficult should it be to change your PC? And finally, we discuss one of our favorite monsters, that of the sorcerer slash wizard. Again, welcome to Season 5, Episode 8 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me as usual is Brian, and we are still saying we are from Beer Star Games.
Yeah, that's my company, so that's probably not going to change.
All right, excellent. Yeah. And of course, as I like to call him, the man himself, George. Welcome.
Hey, guys.
Yeah, I don't know why. That just kind of stuck, and I like it.
I'm happy. Very happy.
So when everything goes wrong, it's the man. The man.
Yeah.
So.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
Anything exciting that we should know about before we hit the news?
No, I think the news is the exciting part.
All right. Well, first up, we want to remind everyone that if you live near or about Winchester, Virginia, that 1D4 Con is happening Friday the 26th through Sunday the 28th of April. So you have a little time. However, there is no more pre-registration for it. That said, you can still get passes there, and it looks like the Friday passes for either 1 day passes for either Friday or Sunday are $10. The Saturday pass for 1 day is $13, and a 2 day pass is $19, and a 3 day is $25. So that's kind of cool. You know,
it is cool.
You know, so
you know, I registered for that con, and even on their Facebook page, there's a lot of like good banter going back and forth. So it's doing well.
Yeah, I think it, from what I can gather, it has a good vibe. So, you know, you're going to go. You can report back to us how it went.
I'm doing everything I can to go. That is true.
Yeah, so I hopefully you can do that, and I look forward to seeing how that went. This is interesting on two fronts. One is apparently a rare, they're calling it a manuscript of one of the earliest existing, or what they're calling the earliest existing version of D&D, to be on display at the National Museum of Play. Now, first off, I never knew there was a National Museum of Play.
That's a museum of everything.
Yeah. Well, I've just never heard of this one. So that's number one. And second, it's interesting that this thing cropped up, and it has a Don't you love how they have like weird names for like rare objects? And in this case, they're calling it the hold on, where is it here?
The Dalun manuscript.
Manuscript, because that was, I guess, one of the original owners of this manuscript, one of the previous owners. And it, you know, and there's a link to the show notes, obviously, to these things. And it is interesting because they do show some pictures where there are items in the manuscript that, as you look into the various other versions of some of the original D&D supplements, you can see the progression, or like where certain rules were taken from chainmail and just like put wholesale into the manuscript. So that's kind of it's kind of a cool item, but it's going to be on display as part of their exhibition exploring 300 years of games, puzzles, and public amusements. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
So. And then, of course, we did get the nominees for the Origin Awards have been announced.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go through them, but it's because it's just a huge list and there's lots of them.
Yes.
Although, I guess, you know, one of your favorite games is listed for Best Role-Playing Game.
Yeah. Which one are we talking? We're talking about Dungeon World?
Oh,
I don't remember now.
I was thinking Marvel Heroic.
Oh, yeah. Well, did Marvel Heroic not release early enough last year to be Origins? I thought it already won one.
This is the 2013, so no, apparently not.
I don't know.
But
Well, hooray then.
Yeah, so it's Iron Kingdoms, Full Metal Fantasy, Marvel Heroic, Monster Hearts, which I've never heard of.
Monster Hearts is great.
I've just never heard of it, so.
Monster Hearts is a Dungeon World hack, which is hilarious because Dungeon World is an Apocalypse World hack. And it's all about teenage monsters in high school.
Okay, well, there you go. That's kind of interesting. Knights of the Crusades and the Primeval RPG from Hugo 7. So, but there's some, you know, there's some interesting items on here. But those were that was kind of the big one. So you can check in the show notes for the link to the list, and you'll because they have other things besides RPGs. Obviously, they have like miniature rules and gaming accessories and things like that. So, but that's kind of cool that that's been released. Here's an item that we didn't really talk about this year a lot, which was the RPG Superstar contest from Paizo. A winner been announced. Stephen Helt, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. So that's kind of cool. You know, I always forget that contest is going on. I think mainly because I don't really do much with it.
Well, I think we talked about it when it first started, but towards the end, the rounds get kind of are like two weeks long, yeah. Aren't they?
I don't know.
It takes a while to get to the end because they're writing like adventures at the end.
Well, yeah. I think part of the problem is the reason that we don't cover a lot of this is that usually our recording schedule and their review schedule don't hash up at all. Mm-hmm. So it's like when we're ready to report the news, the only thing we can report is the stuff that happened like a week ago, and they're in the middle of like doing something where they haven't announced a winner yet. So it's kind of hard. But that's kind of it for the mainstream. Well, not the mainstream news, but the I'm going to go with the non-Kickstarter news for the moment. Because then we have a whole bunch of Kickstarter stuff.
Yeah.
First up is, I mean, as you guys know, one of my favorite things that I've gotten from one of the more recent Kickstarters is my little wooden vehicle set, you know, little carts and stuff, which was all part of that fantasy village set.
Mm-hmm.
The people that did that, they actually have a new one for, it has 17 days to go at the time that we're recording this, for an East Asian village. And it actually, you know, the pictures that they have of their prototypes looks good. So if you're in the need for, some sort of, Eastern influence type fantasy buildings or stuff, might be something to look at. Because, like I said, I remember that just me getting the vehicle set wasn't that expensive at all. And I love them. So.
Whoa, that does look cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Check it out before. That's pretty badass.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're really into that, or
if you've got a lot of shelf space,
right,
then you should totally get on this.
Well, yeah. You know, I don't and I haven't yet played Legend of the Five Rings, which people are liking more and more and more, it seems. And I wonder if it uses minis, and if so, you know, obviously East Asian village is the way to roll.
Well, what I do like is they always have those little, like I said, for me, I can't buy the whole village, but they always have, like, for example, they have an ox cart, and they have, like, this little arch bridge, and they have another ornate bridge, and I'm thinking, oh, and a boat dock. All those kind of things, I can actually see, you know, because they don't take up a crap load of space, but they're nice to put out and use. So I can see if you get the pledges that do that. And they're already, I think this one's already backed. If I remember, let me go up to the top. Yeah, they only were wanting $8,000 to actually do it. They're at $38,000 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the funny thing is that they're just barely finishing sending out the last of the last Kickstarter. But that was the stuff that they're sending out now was the really huge, massive orders. People that bought like every single piece. So, and they say if they get enough for this one, they're actually going to hire somebody to help them do the assembly. You know, some of the pieces are pre-assembled. They're actually hiring somebody who was a backer on the last project, who apparently was really enthusiastic about this, to help them assemble. So that's kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. Yeah. So it's funny though.
And then this was an interesting one, is the Obsidian Portal Reforge.
Yeah.
So if you're an Obsidian Portal user and you don't know about this, I don't know. I think you've been under a rock.
Yeah, you haven't been reading your emails, but apparently you're listening to podcasts. I don't know what's going on there.
I don't know. But, you know, if I used Obsidian Portal, I would back this.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, I don't right now. So it would be silly of me to to back it.
But it's silly of you to not use Obsidian Portal, though. So that's just like equal.
Gee, thanks. But it's, you know, they
silliness.
Well, you know, I. That's not the way I'm gaming right now.
I don't use it either. So. I have to say. But maybe I will if it's being reforged. That's exciting.
Ooh.
I know.
Yeah, there you go. It has 10 days to go, and they've already raised, at the at this point of contact, 46,811. So I bet Micah is really excited about that. Because, you know, the Obsidian Portal has won, what, the Annie Awards a few times?
A few times, yes. I think three.
Yeah.
At different levels. Yeah. Here's my real quick pitch to everyone listening. If you don't use Obsidian Portal yet, but you think you might in the future, this might be a good idea to back it anyway. It's $35 for a year membership. You don't have to use that time immediately after the Kickstarter starts. So if you want to wait till all the reforging is done and then activate it, you can do that. They're totally cool with that. And they've, because of one of their stretch goals is they add an extra month onto that. Like every so much they get over the limit. So right now it's actually a year and 4 months for $35, which is a significant discount off of what it normally is to be at of a full member of Obsidian Portal and have all the benefits of a full account.
Yeah, and so, and a lot of their, I won't lie, a lot of their limited, you know, they have different pledge levels, and some of their limited pledge levels, they're practically full on almost all of them.
Yeah, because some of them were,
You know, like they had the this map maker, this custom map for your campaign. There, you know, there were only 20 of them, and there was a $500 pledge gone. It's like, wow, that's impressive. That, you know,
yeah,
that's kind of cool. I don't think any of the maps that I'd ever have, that I've ever made for my games, even my cricket chicken scratch ones, I don't know if I'd want a professional guy actually embellishing upon that in any way. I'd almost rather say, you know what, draw me a new one.
You know, it's nerve-wracking. I had to design a map for the Midgard Bestiary. There's an adventure that's finally coming out this year that was part of that, part of one of the stretch goals. And so I had to draw out a battle map, which was then being handed over to a professional cartographer. And it's stressful, you know, because these guys like know what they're doing, but they have to mimic what I'm doing to an extent. Yeah. But, I'm with you there. Like I liked doing that. It was exciting. I'm still very excited to see what it looks like in the end. But it's also I feel like I kind of want to just like tell them to do what's awesome. And that wasn't part of the deal.
Yeah, do what's awesome. Just do whatever you think. Yeah. So the next Kickstarter we have is an interesting one. It is because the game already exists. It's actually, you can actually freely get it online. It's called Engine Heart. It's basically one. I kind of think that it drew from the old from the Disney movie WALL-E in a way, because it's like a role playing game of small service robots in the aftermath of human extinction.
Ooh.
And all they're trying to do is actually get a print run, because apparently a lot of their fans were like, we would like to see this in print. So they figured, well, how are we going to get this in print? And this was their way to do that. And so right now there's 132 backers. They are actually only about, looks like $1,200 away from their stretch goal, which is, I mean, not their stretch goal, but their goal, which is only $7,500. And there's still 26 days to go. So that actually is not too bad. And the print book, if you actually wanted the print book, let's see, where is... I think the print is $40.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what's interesting is actually one of the stores that have asked to get involved, you know, for dealers, is in my state, but it's in a part of the state that I've never been to. I've never even heard of the company. So, but it's all over the United States. So that's, you know, it's kind of cool. I'm always impressed that, you know, what people are using Kickstarters for. It's like, well, we have a product that we just kind of made for fun, and people want to see it in print, and the only way we can do it is to do X.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. The next one is kind of interesting. It's called Atlantis: The Second Age. And the reason I thought it was interesting is, I don't know if any of you guys used to play, well, I don't know how long you guys have been playing, but one of their inspirations is the old Bard game, Atlantean Trilogy.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with Brian.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that the rule book was was actually based on some other Bard game material. So it had one of the more early editions of alchemy, if you will. You know, like, you're an alchemist. You need your stuff. And anyway, long story short, it's an old game. You look in the 80s, mid-80s.
Ooh, 80s, huh? Ugh.
Well, the game itself. But it's interesting that it's based off of that, because I was thinking, I wonder if that's okay. Apparently it is. I don't know. But it's interesting because the basic... It uses a D20 mechanic, but it's not D20. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the 20-sided die is common into a lot of games. And so the success table is something that I'm very familiar with. It's like, wow, I remember this, because it's very similar to several games that were based off of the same set of Bard games. But, you know, it looks like, you know, the guy that's doing it is very passionate. He's done other RPGs. And right now, the only thing they want... Their first stretch goal is for $14,000 is to make the book in color. Right now, they only have... Right now, they're funded at $7,006.
Mm-hmm.
They were only looking for $6,500, and there's still 22 days to go, which is kind of cool. And I think for a book right now... it's $50 for the book. That's the only downside. But I don't know. But I don't know how big the book is either. I don't think I saw that in here. But I would imagine, you know, $50 for a rule book is almost standard these days. I hate to say
it. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it pretty much is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to think about that, because I remember when I first started playing first edition D&D, it's like, you know, $10 for this book, $8 for this book. I think the player's handbook was like $8.50 or something bizarre like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah... $50? Okay. And, you know, I think the original Hero System 5th Edition, I think, was $50 or something like that. And think about how large that thing is. You can deflect bullets with it. you can. I think that's its superpower. So, and last but not least in the Kickstarters, which was just announced today, I believe, is the Kickstarter for the Fate Dice.
Fate Dice! I'm not actually as excited as I just made it out to seem. they're fudge dice, guys.
Yeah.
They're fudge dice.
Right.
Only these fudge dice cost you $20 for six.
I think it's...
Am I wrong about that? Tell me I'm wrong, because...
You're not wrong.
I'm not wrong?
You are not wrong.
It is... I thought it was 18 for 12.
That's better.
Yeah.
That's a lot better.
Because it's three sets of four.
But the picture shows a set of six.
It looks like six, but it's two sets of... Well, you know...
It's two sets of six?
You six and six is 12.
That's $20 or more gets you any one of our $15 sets. Da-da-da-da-da.
Yes, it says, each package contains three sets of four 16-millimeter fudge dice...
Okay, yeah, so there is a layer. It's a layer deep. I didn't notice that in the picture.
Right.
All right, so that's better. That's
Except that only gets you those. Those don't get you the extra special dice that they're trying to manufacture.
Actually, though, if you pledge that amount when they hit the different goals, you can change which set you get.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right, but I think he was saying that the other
you have to add $5.
We're going to be a little bit more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want the $23 ones, yeah.
Right, exactly. And then I guess as they hit their stretch goals, there'll be different sets that you can choose. So you don't have to choose which ones you get until afterwards, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess if you need fudge or fate dice, this you know, if you like them, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, right now he was only asking 10,000. He's at 18,000.
Yeah, people really want these dice for some reason. We knew there was a big demand before the Kickstarter even started.
So, and there's 35 days to go. I'd like to see how high this one goes.
Yeah. They do look nicer than the fudge dice I have, which are just like those blue and red fudge dice, which are they come in the long skinny tube that are pretty much the only fudge dice you can buy these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I shelled out a little too much money about a year ago for some Q Workshop ones.
Yeah.
And these are definitely on the Kickstarter cheaper than the Q Workshop money I spent.
Oh, well, yeah, because everything is cheaper than Q Workshop dice.
No kidding, right?
Yeah. The only the other major difference is that they've changed the arrangement of the plus, minus, and blank sides.
Yeah,
but do we actually care about that? Because there's still six sides.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's what they've done because they put a minus opposite a plus, and then the blanks are opposite.
Okay.
So it's like where the one, you know, because usually one and because usually what happens is that on a six sided dice, the one and all the opposite faces add up to seven.
Okay.
So what they've done is where the one would be is a minus, and where the six would be is a plus, and where the two would be is a minus, and where the five would be is a plus.
Okay. Well, that's fair.
You know, because I guess they say it's.
Does that help with probability or something?
I don't know. They just, I think they're doing that A just because they were a little anal and they want, that's differentiator.
Okay. Sure.
You know, that's all I can say on that. All right. And last but not least, you have some stuff.
Yeah. Some of my stuff sort of happened at the same time. So I'm going to do this real quick for you guys. If you like my Pathfinder stuff, Urban Dressing Temples released today, which is definitely, I think, the most interesting of the Urban Dressing line that I've done. It's all temples. So it's just like the other Urban Dressing stuff. You've heard me talk about it before. You roll on the table, you get a description, all this good stuff. I really like this one. It's got three different tables for different types of tithing for evil, neutral, and good deities. It's got a random clergy generator that has all sorts of weird stuff connected to it. And it's got a separate description table. It's got the normal description table that we normally have that gives you like the outside of the building and what it looks like. And then it's got another table that gives you things that change the way the building looks based on the domains of the gods worshipped there. So I think that's really cool, even if you don't play Pathfinder. I love that. If you are a fan of D&D 4th Edition, the Midgard Bonus Bestiary released today. This was funded through the Midgard Bestiary book Kickstarter from last year. It was originally going to be three bestiaries. They've decided to do it all as one. You can get the whole thing for $3, and I think it's 12 new monsters. I'll completely set it out, and it's got one of my favorite Midgard monsters in it, the Ocular Swarm, which is a swarm of eyes that will rip your player's eyes from their sockets to add to its own swarm. Pretty awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. And my last announcement is pulp related, as I do like to shill pulp as it is. I'm sure listeners know that this past weekend was the Boston Marathon. And some unfortunate things happened during the Boston Marathon. I actually was not very far from the site of that event. I was one of the people who had to be evacuated out of the area. But everyone's fine. Don't worry about that stuff. But I do, as a Bostonian, as somebody who runs a Boston-based company, you know, this is a pulp is a game that premiered at the Boston Festival of Indie Games. I wanted to do something. So all sales starting today, which is Tuesday, till next Tuesday, the 23rd of pulp, all the profits from those sales are going to go right to the Red Cross. So if you don't have pulp yet, you're thinking about picking it up, pick it up. And I won't get any money, but the Red Cross will. That's a good thing.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Oh, hey, you know what? I did forget one item in the news, and this really isn't a news item. This is more of an interesting observation that came out. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about the last episode, we were talking about Storm Battalion and the differences between Indiegogo and Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Eloy of Third Eye Games, who was actually involved with Storm Battalion, he actually had a blog post where he talked about Indiegogo versus Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And he said there were there were some things that actually cropped up, you know, some major differences that he saw between the two. And the interesting thing is there were all the things that you brought up. One was the updates. You didn't, you know, the updates are horrible in Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
Two, the way Indiegogo takes money. because in Kickstarter, your money doesn't come out until the project ends and it's been
funded.
That's
right.
Whereas Indiegogo takes out immediately. The other one was, it's just traffic. He says there just is not enough traffic on Indiegogo compared to Kickstarter. And when people say, well, why aren't you using Kickstarter instead? He says there's a weird level of scorn. And so he just says that from now on, he's just going to probably end up using Kickstarter for any future projects.
Well, sure.
So I just thought that was interesting because we talked about it, and then he actually had wrote this blog post about it, and it pretty much said the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, Indiegogo is good for certain things. But Kickstarter has definitely sort of cornered its area of the market, and you can get a certain amount of money just from being on Kickstarter, a certain amount of notice.
Yeah, he said the traffic was way less than they usually get on Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And the end line, I think, is interesting. He said, let's face it, Kickstarter is the same as Xerox and Q-Tip now. They're just synonymous with crowdfunding and RPGs especially.
Yep.
So, kind of an interesting, because yeah, I don't think outside of Storm Battalion, I don't think we've ever covered any other RPG product from Indiegogo.
I think we've talked about things here and there. I mean, there was that Legends of the Flaming Princess run where they had like the 30 projects going at once.
Oh, okay.
It's this and that, but it's less frequent.
Yeah, I didn't know James was actually. Did one on any, but that kind of makes sense. So, okay, well, that covers the news, unless we have anything else.
That's good.
All right, well, let's hit the first one, the too many game accessories debate. I call this debate to order.
Cool. let me tell you a very, very short story. Remember, 2 weeks ago when we were talking about the recent sales of some role-playing games, and it turned out that a Star Wars game was like number 2 on the list, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I looked it up. And lo and behold, it's a Fantasy Flight Games. It's called Star Wars Edge of the Empire.
Yeah.
And so I started reading about it. And it is very much like another Fantasy Flight Games product, Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition. Meaning, right, they've got very similar dice. You know, they're special dice that have symbols on it and not numbers. They've got tons of cards. So they've got like, I mean, not the Star Wars game, but the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay one. There's like, insanity cards for when you meet monsters of chaos, and action cards and career cards, and, you know, just stuff upon stuff. Even your character sheet in the standard version of the game is pretty small, but you attach all these cards around it to have it in front of you so everything is really clear. Well, in that game and in the Star Wars game, which is apparently, you know, gaining some popularity, if you were to actually play it the way it's written and sit down,
mm-hmm.
you will have a shit ton of accessories on the table in front of you. Definitely to rival any board game I've ever seen, including Arkham Horror and some crazy Avalon Hill stuff. No question.
Yeah, it's a very pretty little box set. It's got lots of stuff.
It's beautiful. And, I've got the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay myself, and I've read through it. And even though both of these games come with a written version that they're calling light, where mm-hmm. you can play it without all that stuff, it's really easy to see how accessorized it is. So I started to think about my own Pathfinder game, where I've got regular dice. I've got some chips I'm using for like a modified Benny system. I've got the really awesomely fun critical hit cards. And I know that the fumble cards are fun too. And then there's also some like, you know, if I'm doing certain adventures, there's like a sort of tarot card deck. I forget what those are called. Anyway, it would be very easy for me to full on accessorize my game with piece after piece after piece. And what I'm wondering is, am I going to get too far, and what am I giving up if I do that?
Well, first of all, you know you've gone too far when you buy a Chinese village.
Yeah, you're right.
Hey, you never know. You know, you never know. Maybe have dueling samurais. I don't know. Maybe playing
Jeff.
Maybe
have you already backed the Chinese village, Jeff?
No, I have not backed the Chinese village. Sadly, I have other things that demand my currency. That, and trust me, the things that that demand my currency right now are way more expensive than anything that Chinese village can throw out.
Yeah.
I think there's two different questions here, which I may have brought upon the conversation by accident, and for which I apologize. There's how many accessories that the designers can include in the game, where they're specifically referencing things that you need to purchase or that will come in this ridiculous box set that you need to use if you go by their description. And then there's how many accessories you actually have at your game table, which can be more. My inkling as both a GM and a designer is to minimize what you need to play the game as rules is written. I don't like to be told or even given a lot of stuff because I feel like I've got to keep it all together and I've got to keep track of things. And
yeah,
I don't want to do that. I've got a couple of the little box sets that WotC put out for like the Monster Vault and the Monster Vault 2. And I deconstructed those things so quick. The books that came in the boxes are on the shelf. I threw out the boxes. I've got the monster tokens in a plastic bag somewhere in like my friend's apartment, I think. Seriously, because they're not things that I'm going to use all the time. They're not things that I need. I want the book. I bought those because I wanted the book.
Well, I mean, I think this also kind of will edge on the territory of miniatures in a way, because miniatures are accessories.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know? And this is where, you know, I come in because, you know, obviously I like using miniatures in my game. But on the other hand, A, I can't buy enough miniatures. And B, there's a lot of variety, which is why I've really, really have gotten into the printable paper minis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because it's like, okay, I need some Zulu warriors. I don't have miniatures to represent Zulu warriors. Oh, but I can go over to Drive-Thru RPG and buy paper Zulu warriors, and then I can print out as many as I need. Fantastic.
Dude, Jeff, you love those Zulu warriors. Have you not printed out anything since you got those Zulu warriors like 2 years ago? What is going on here?
Well, the funny thing
Zulu
is
Zulu warriors in a good map, and Jeff is done. That's it.
Hey, you laugh, but I've used those Zulu warriors a lot.
I guess so. This is your ultimate example of paper minis.
Well, you know, and then of course, especially with I was playing some sessions of Deadlands. You know, paper minis for all the cowboys is because it's like I'm not going to go ahead and have cowboy minis. I'm just not, and it's not.
Sure.
Matter of fact, you can't even go to the store and get them. But so those type of accessories, yeah, you can. I think you can have too many because I remember. You remember when the one of the many D&D miniature games came out where they had those plastic minis.
Well, yeah. That you're describing several different ones now.
Right. I was thinking specifically of the one that came out right after the 3.0 rules came out.
Okay, sure, yeah.
You know, because it was like you'd buy a set and you wouldn't know what minis you were actually getting in that set box. It was like their way of making it collectible. Yeah. So, and I've actually remember seeing pictures of people with like walls. You know, with shelves, and that's where all the minis were. And you're just like, holy crap, that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that there. I mean, granted, that was a miniature game, but it's just that's another game. You're just like, really? That's a lot of stuff to get just to play a game. So
I had a friend who was really into that. We never played the miniatures game, but he didn't buy much else, but he really liked the minis. So he bought like boxes, and when I mean box, I guess what I mean is case. It's like a box of boxes of minis.
Yes, I know a lot of people that did that.
On multiple occasions, because he had the money at the time, and he really liked them. And we've got a lot of duplicates, which is great. I don't know. Like he's got an organizational system that I still haven't quite figured out. But I can say, you know, Matt, I need goblins. And we're like, great. And he'll pull out the goblin box.
Right, and you're like, you know what? I need some demons. Oh, no problem. I got a box of them.
Exactly, and I would never do that. Like, I would never invest that money, which I think is probably one of the reasons why he did it, because it was something he liked that he knew I wasn't going to do.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, but that, and I think that's the trick with gamers, is you got to be in a gaming group where everyone buys at least something different, so that when it comes down to it, you can share those accessories.
Yeah. I mean, we use those miniatures for all sorts of things. If I'm running something weird from the Midgard Bestiary and he doesn't have it, I just pull out a freaking owlbear because it's the same size and I put it on the map and I say, this is an ocular swarm.
No, it's just because you want to use the owlbear mini.
I love the owlbear mini. It's righteous.
So,
but, you know, isn't it easy, though, to, or at least it is for me, to go to a store or to be online and be like, oh, you know, that deck of additional cards or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
man, that's going to be fun. And well, then before you know it, you're managing accessories as resources instead of...
well, I mean, because that
should do, you know?
Yeah,
you're weak-willed, man. No.
I am.
Well, I'm just thinking of the... I don't know. Is it the magic item cards or whatever that Paizo has?
Yeah, Paizo has a deck of all sorts of things.
Yeah, but they're, I mean, cool, which are cool, and I have them, but I actually realize that they're cool and they're cool visuals, but I've never been able to use them practically in a game.
Yeah, I won't buy them. I find them far too limiting. I like the idea of them, but the wealth of magic items I have at my disposal as a GM is more than 54.
Well, that's, you know? It's like, so you buy a deck of cards and you go like, I got to buy more. And then, oh, well, you know what? I'm doing the Second Darkness campaign. I should get the Second Darkness set so I have all the magic items from the Second Darkness.
You know, that would be cool. I will say this. Paizo has great adventure lines. If I was running one of their adventure paths straight, which I've considered doing, and they had a deck for that path, I would probably pick it up.
Well, no, because, I mean, yeah.
Because then it's just like, I'm not limiting myself anymore. I'm just... adding on to my options. Most of the times, my problem with accessories is I find that they're very limiting. You know, I don't have the right mini for this. I don't have the right terrain for this, you know. Or it's like, I guess I'm going to do another temple because that's what I've got. Like, I don't want to do that. I want to be able to go into Sigil and do whatever I need to do.
Well, that's why... it's just like the dungeon work stuff.
The dungeon work stuff? What does that mean?
I'm sorry. Dwarven Forge stuff.
Dwarven Forge, yeah.
Strangely enough, Dungeon Works was a very cheap product that was made years ago where there was a magnetic board for the things, and the pieces had magnetic bottoms, so they stuck to the board.
I am vaguely familiar with what you're talking about, and it scares me, Jeff.
Yeah.
I'm out of that one.
Yeah, that was an old early 90s product.
Mm.
So, I mean, it predates Dwarven Forge and everything else. But, you know, like the Dwarven Forge pieces are like, you know, I have some of the molds for the Hertz Arts castle molds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making them. I don't do it right now just because it's a lot of time and effort, and I just don't really want to spend. But, you know, making those pieces, if you make them, they're cool. But, again, there's a lot of accessories. Where are you going to store it? So,
yep.
I mean, I think that's the trick with accessories. Can you have too many accessories?
Yep.
It depends on your available space and what you're trying to accomplish.
Oh, yeah. As a GM, it's all about you. It's all about the space you have, how much time you want to devote to it. I'm all for people making spectacular customized terrain for every single session. If that's what you want to do and you've got the time doing it and you enjoy it, that's awesome. But I'm not going to do it, and I don't want to be involved in an RPG like as a designer where we're assuming you're going to do these things.
Yeah,
and that's where a lot of people got upset with the newer 3.5 books and then with 4th edition, because there was an assumption that you were using miniatures all of a sudden.
Yep.
Not even that you were using like their maps and their miniatures. There was an assumption you were using miniatures and a grid. And people were like, what if I'm not doing that? And they got mad. And of course, they kept doing it, and it just got worse from there. And I don't like that. Yeah, 4E is a tactical game, and I sort of understand why they did that. And it was really easy to extrapolate if you wanted to extrapolate it. But because it was written with that in mind, people felt like they couldn't not use those things, because then they would be breaking the rules.
Well, you know, Savage Worlds is a little like that in a way. Although Savage Worlds,
I feel like the mini's suggestion in 4E is way more heavy-handed than...
It's not a suggestion. It's not like you could... They never use the phrase, you could use this. They say, 5 squares is your movement. Like
right.
that. It doesn't say 30 feet equals 6 squares. It says right, 6 right. squares. Go. Yeah. That's the difference.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I think Savage World isn't everything in inches.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. But...
My experience with Savage Worlds is with their Explorer's Guide, and I know some of the things were made vaguer in that.
Well, it is very vague, and one of the things I always tell people that I liked about Savage Worlds is that, yeah, you have these measurements, but there's no mention that you absolutely need to use a grid, and if you have the templates, you don't need a grid either.
Sure, yeah.
So you can just go like, here's the ruler, 6 inches, I move there, done.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a little more flexibility in that, I suppose.
Yeah, I think what I was thinking about the whole thing is that it strikes me that, way back when I started gaming, there was board games and then there was role-playing games. And maybe a few things beginning to crop up in between. But now I think with all the possible accessories, there's no question that you have much more of a spectrum, where you can play OSR, some OSR game where all you have is dice and a piece of paper and a pencil, or you can go the other way, where you're playing like Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd, that's in the middle, I guess, or pure hardcore board game. And, I don't care what you play as long as you have fun, but I do think that, like, role players, the more they add to the table, they got to realize you only have so much time and so much stuff you can do, what's going to go away?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's worth considering, as you place more and more stuff on that table, even though it looks awesome or it might be fun, I have those Paizo critical hit cards that I love. I think they're awesome.
They're awesome.
I put them on the table every time. And in my last three sessions, they have been used once.
Why? Because one's getting critical hits, or are you just forgetting to use the cards?
No, it's an option. You don't have to take it. You can do the, whatever it is as the damage stat.
No, that's boring. Why aren't people pulling those cards? Those cards are great.
But also, people weren't critical hitting as much. But, that's what happens with accessories. They get these side things, and sometimes they're cool, and sometimes they're not, and... Dude,
you need new players. If they don't want to pull cards out of that deck, they're not your friends.
Well, yeah.
Well, then you need to say, well, you've encountered this deck of cards, and now you have to pull a card, and it's going to do something horrible to you.
No, I've never gotten a player to pull a card out of the deck of many things. They figure out what it is right away, and they're just like, no, absolutely not. But like, you can get a miracle or a castle. I'm like, no.
The old classic Wand of Wonder was much more fun. because it was usually less deadly, but it had some really serious things, like silly things. Like, I think one of the old results in the old Wand of Wonder was like a stream of butterflies.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, oddly enough. Yeah.
And I think one of the other ones was like a stream of like small diamonds that would do like one hit point of damage each or something like that. It was that was a much goofier and more fun Magic item. Yeah, deck of many things. Usually most players are like, no.
That's horrifying, the deck of many things.
Yeah, it's horrifying in too many ways.
By the way, I'm looking at the Savage Worlds rules right now, and I'm actually surprised I had forgotten this or suppressed it, that it actually says, regarding games without miniatures, that weapon ranges, character, vehicle movement rates are all based on using figures, and that's why and how this game is built. But if you don't want to, you don't gotta. Just for like one tiny little paragraph.
Yeah.
Hey, if it's in the rules, it makes all the difference for some people. If they have that little line that says, don't worry about it, like that changes people's perspective on life.
Yes, I agree.
And I don't quite understand that, but it happens to enough people that you sort of have to go with it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah,
people really do worry about those sort of canonized notions, when it's a freaking imagination game. I don't get their...
Yeah.
Whatever. It's like a religion.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to the next debate, I suppose.
Okay.
Which you brought up, which is how difficult should it be to change your PC? Exactly what we were talking about.
Okay. So we can only go so far on this one. But I'll tell you real quick. I recently got an Xbox after not wanting one in my home for a long time, because I am convinced that now that it is there, I won't get any work done. But... my friend sold me his old Xbox because he's got a new one. And when he did, he gave me his Skylanders game. If you've seen any children's TV recently, it's got its own little stand that you plug into the Xbox. And it comes with a few miniatures, and you can buy more. And as you're playing the game, you swap out the miniatures, and that's your avatar for the game. And each one has different powers. My four-year-old is so excited that we have this game. She was playing it, and she liked playing the game, but what she liked most of all was being able to pull a figure off the stand. The game immediately pauses, and then she gets to pick who she wants to be, and it doesn't send her back to like the beginning point or anything like that. She just keep going with that new character. It is instant gratification in its purest form.
That's pretty awesome.
It's pretty awesome the way it works. It works. It's really smooth, and it sort of encourages you to do it to a certain extent. I mean, she doesn't get these layers of gaming because she's 4, but you'll get to a certain area and it'll say, you know, gear type Skylanders are more powerful in this zone, or you need a water type to get through this gate, and they're always optional. But like, it almost encourages you to hot swap your characters as you play it. But she loves it. As a little kid, it's just like she's got 12 little figurines in front of her, and she can keep swapping them out as often as she wants. And that made me think about tabletop games, because in a tabletop game, if you want to hot swap your character, most of the time you need to die or you need to retire your character. And then there's other changes that are just as hard to make sometimes, where you pick defeat a third level, now you're 12, and that feat's not doing much for you. A lot of game systems don't have any way for you to fix that. They sort of addressed it in 4th edition. In 4th edition, most things could be, you could swap one thing every level up, essentially, as long as you had DM approval, and that was written into the rules. But a lot of games have no system like that. You're sort of locked in. And in a way, it rewards game mastery. It rewards planning. In other ways, it sort of punishes players for being in the moment, and I don't like that. And I was just curious what you guys think about that. How much should we be able to change our character, and how easy should it be? Should it be like an epic level quest like it is in a lot of MMOs to get that token to swap out all your perks? Or should it be easier than that? Should you just be able to jump from mage to fighter?
I don't know. I think it depends on the game. Games like, strangely enough, like the old hero system, Champions specifically.
Yeah.
Because of the way the superhero genre is. And I've always, even though they've never explicitly said it in any of the rules,
mm-hmm.
They've almost always hinted that the assumption is as the characters develop, you would probably redesign them.
Uh-huh.
You know, without like a penalty. Like,
sure.
You know, or you're talking to the GM and there will be the equivalent of a radiation accident kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? So coming from that sort of background, and that's kind of the background, I don't really have, you know, I've never required that players die. It's like, oh, you know mm-hmm. what? I don't feel like playing this character right now. I want to play this other guy. Okay. And then maybe later on they want to play that other guy again. Sure. No problem.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that. Especially... And I think what you have to do that is the campaign or the game has to allow for that. And I think there's a lot of games that it's not allowed for that. It kind of depends on what you're running. If you're running like this massive quest where the game master has to assume that, you know, the same players are going to start the quest and end the quest, in that kind of setting, you can't really, I wouldn't expect the people to be changing out characters all the time, you know. Usually not, because it's like, well, what's the buy-in for, you know, these 4 characters have buy-in because of the event that made them do the quest in the first place, where other characters that come in really don't have that kind of buy-in. Mm-hmm. They almost could care less. And that's why sometimes in certain adventures where, well, the entire party has almost died, it's like, well, who's the original players? They're the ones that agreed to this thing. Why am I involved? Just because I came along and I'm a new player? I've had that happen. It's just like, well, why are we here? Wait a minute. So you're saying you started with these 5 characters, and out of these 5 characters, no one's from the original party that started this adventure? Well, why are we on this adventure in the first place anymore? You know, I've seen that. So
I hear you.
So if the game is flexible, or you're studying, or whatever you're doing is flexible, I've seen all kinds of weird ones. Like, I've seen people say, well, there's an adventuring guild, and, you know, all characters, just for whatever reason, belong to this guild, so... Whoever, you know, whatever adventure comes apart, you know, whoever is present, whatever characters they bring, that's who's available at the Adventures Guild to do the adventure kind of thing. And so I get, you know, like I said, so it depends on what kind of setting you're doing. And I think, generally speaking, what's the purpose of gaming? Let's be honest.
Well, obviously, have fun.
Exactly. So This is going to sound strange, but if you're doing something and no one's having fun, then change it. I'm all about that.
Yeah, this is one of those weird times where I agree with Jeff. Like I do all those things. Like if my player wants to change his character, I pretty much allow him to do so. Like I don't want people to change their characters dramatically, but I'll let them to change like a little bit at a time and get where they need to go. Or if they want to make a big change, then I'm gonna let them hop swap their character. It's like, all right, you're not playing Steve anymore. You're playing Jim, and Steve is gonna go do this thing. And I've let people go back to their old characters, and it's fine, and we make it work.
Yeah,
because
I think I'm much more likely to either do that, you know, if they want to switch characters completely. But if they've been playing a while with somebody, mm-hmm. I think I'm much more likely to try to find a way to make it fit the story. I don't know why. I sometimes feel like yes and has a limit where you're not challenging the role play enough if you just win. You know, and so there's times when if I sense that someone is just maybe like working too hard just to, you know, maximize stats or something like that, when I want them to play who they're playing, that I would probably turn it into some kind of quest or a possibility to keep them going. But if they said, you know, oh gosh, I got this guy and I really hate it, I really want to play a magic user, then, you know, yeah, somebody would trip and fall and somebody else would show up. No sweat, you know?
Trip and fall like that.
Yeah, why not, right? All you need is a root. Everybody's got roots. Sticking out, but I don't know. I sort of feel uncomfortable with, like, I want there to be as much flexibility as possible, but if the world is flexible and they can add to it, and then too easily, like, their character is also, I feel like it might just be too fluid to present the right challenges.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you don't want your abilities to be, you want to reward people for thinking, but solidly mechanically over time. Like that is, I agree with you. You don't want to be just being in the middle of an encounter and have the fighter become a mage because it's used to become a mage right now.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Although I do like the idea of sort of a guild style game sometimes where you're assembling your team for the mission at hand. That is cool, but it's a very different kind of game.
Right.
Where you're not like, you're probably not pursuing this one big goal that everyone has personal ties to the whole time. You're more, it's more of a mercenary, an Ocean 11's type of game.
Well, I don't know if it would be completely mercenary, but you know.
But mercenary, I just mean like, yeah.
More like an army and you're assembling different squads.
Yeah.
Well, I would think it would more, yeah, it's kind of like that. I was thinking more like, you know, that's kind of what it is. It's just, okay. I actually more think of more along the lines of, you know, like some sort of like superhero group, you know.
Where sure,
they have,
sure.
They have tons of members and just like, well, whoever's ready, whoever's available, that's who does the adventure.
Well, that's very different, right? It's very different from like a Justice League standpoint where they're like, who's near X city? Who can we call on because they happen to be there? Where it's, they're saying, all right, we need our 5 speedsters for this mission. I mean, those are two very different kind of choices.
Well, I mean, and obviously I wouldn't. I mean, again, that's a design decision on how you set up some sort of game like that. Generally speaking, though, I mean, I don't think I've ever run into that where somebody wants to do everyone wants to do the same type of character.
Well, yeah, but I don't mean all speedsters. I mean, where they're picking people for the task at hand, as opposed to being able to swap their characters,
right? No, I understand what
they're
saying.
Feeling like that, you know, or what they feel like playing. They're essentially min maxing their team each mission.
You know, even in a game system that doesn't explicitly say anything about it, I do think it would be fun to take whatever game you've got and say, all right, so that's something you want. You know what? Once you earn, you know, X number of experience points, I'm not going to count that toward your leveling up, if that matters to you. We're going to let you use that to swap something out. And, you know, because on the way you've been trying this and you're going to try it.
Well, Marvel Heroic does that. They have what I like to call parallel leveling, where you're sure you might increase in power a little bit, but it's sort of assumed that at the end of the arc, you are returned to normal, because that's what happens to superheroes, is they go through an arc, they change, and by the end of it, most of the time they go back to sort of their default beginning of the episode state. And there are rules in there where they're like, if you wanted to keep playing the same character and really explore those changes over time, you can do that. But that's not the default. Generally, right. You're not just gaining new powers. You're swapping one power set for another power set. And you right. might have multiple power sets, so some things stay consistent. But,
I haven't had the chance to do this yet, but I've been really thinking about playing a game where the character, like if a character wants to be a magic user or something like a magic user, they don't necessarily have any spells at first. As they try something, like, okay, you know, you've got a magical ability, you don't exactly know what it is, and mm-hmm. then they try to ignite something, and they have a really crap chance of it working out. But the more they use it over time, you know, the more I let them get up to a usable level.
Sure.
I think that could be really fun if somebody said to me, you know, yeah, I've got this fighter here, but that wasn't what I envisioned. And I'm like, all right, you know, your dude, you know, Bart, has lived his whole life fighting. Now he's trying something else. Let him try it on this adventure and see how this works out. So he tries, you know, whatever the hell he's going to try.
Wouldn't be that difficult if you were, instead of using something like a D20, if you were using like a full percentage system, so you get a right. more gradual changes.
Right.
You know, your target number is 50 right now. Now your target number is, you know, 52.
Right.
You know, you could just, I mean, you could do that. Yeah.
I think that could be a lot of fun. Or, you know, even possibly in a Savage Worlds kind of thing where you go from a D4 to a D6. You know, because that D4 sucks, you know?
Sure, sure.
But I don't know. You know, I haven't encountered it that much. That's interesting.
Yeah. All right, any other thoughts on that before we get to our last little topic?
No, that was good.
All right, well, the last little topic is continuing on with our little favorite monster kind of thing. The last time we talked about orcs.
Yay.
And, you know, it was kind of interesting. I was thinking, you know, well, what else can we talk about? And I'm thinking, you know, the funny thing is what's the world's greatest monster, which is other human beings usually, or other things that player characters can be, and what is the classic sword and sorcery villain?
It's got to be that Dark Lord, right?
It has to be, you know, that sorcerer, that evil wizard. I mean, that's just the way I've always felt. And it's like, and it does crop up in a lot of games. It's like, well, the evil wizard has done this. Well, why in the hell is he doing that in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the question is, you know, how different, you know, it's like, are these, you know, you read it in books and it doesn't seem like a lot of times their motives are all that different. Do you guys ever really different? Have you guys ever used this archetype? Have you guys... And a game.
The evil wizard archetype, or just like humanity's bad?
Well, I was thinking the evil wizard archetype.
I mean, George, if you've never used an evil wizard, I suggest you leave the podcast forever. Because, I mean, come on. Who hasn't used an evil wizard at some point? I mean, unless you're not playing fantasy RPGs, it's just like wizards are sometimes bad. You know, just throwing that out there. Yeah, come on. Yes, of course. Evil wizards are great.
Yes.
Yeah. I love them. Love evil wizards.
Right. Well, I know that. But, I mean, do we... I mean, does it seem like we've kind of either overused it or do we...
No.
Are they really different?
No.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, of course they... I mean, they're as different as people are. I mean, you're never going to get sick of using human villains because humans are as diverse as anything. I mean, they're sort of, you know, not troped. And evil wizards can be all sorts of different bad guys because arcane magic is really just a set of tools and is one of the most diverse set of tools, I mean, we've ever come up with in fiction. A wizard can be any number of things, any number of specialties, and it doesn't even matter what their powers are sometimes. It depends on their motivations, which can, you know, run the gamut of humanity.
I think that's what Jeff's getting at, that too often people maybe, right, just make this Dark Lord who's just doing a bunch of bad stuff without specificity or a clear plan. You know, he just wants to take over or mess everything up.
What? Well, that doesn't have anything to do with him being a wizard. Being lazy.
Right, I agree. I mean, he's talking about, here's one of our favorite enemies, you know, this evil sorcerer. is it overused, or what can we do? What can we do to make him special?
Well, right? I got an ancillary question for you. Have you ever used a wizard archetype character, an evil wizard archetype character, in a game that's not a fantasy game?
Yes.
Yes.
I love it. Seriously, I can't run a game without an evil wizard.
Well, I mean, I run primarily fantasy, but I've used evil wizards in Marvel, but I mean, they have evil wizards in Marvel. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
I guess I'm talking about games that normally you wouldn't think there would be an evil wizard archetype.
Like what?
I don't know, some science fiction game.
I did, yeah. A long time ago, I ran a space opera game back when I loved space opera and I enjoyed math. And everything was very pure science fiction-y, except I had the manipulative bad guy be very evil wizard-y. Maybe I was Star Wars influenced or whatever. But
yeah, but I was about to say there's lots of evil wizards in sci-fi. I mean, Emperor Palpatine is an evil wizard. I mean, come on.
Although it's weird. It's sort of cheating to say that because Star Wars is pretty much just fantasy in space. Right.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, a lot of space opera is.
Yeah. But I did that. You know, I was in a really – everything else was pretty straightforward tech science fiction except for my bad guy, which was probably the challenge for the players because tech stuff they could handle and figure out. But what this guy was doing and I didn't tell my players that this is what they were dealing with. So stuff was happening that they were like, this cannot happen. But it did.
Yeah, you know, I mean, anytime somebody is manipulating reality, they're essentially a wizard. So if you're playing a Matrix-type game and there are people who can make guns show up around you, then they're a wizard, you know?
Right. The reason I asked this question is because one of the people I played with a long time ago, as a game master, he admitted that he only had three types of characters that he ever played. No matter what the system.
Uh-huh.
One was the dumb jock, you know, the dumb fighter, the brute fighter. So no matter what game, which is a fairly common, no matter what game you play, there's always some guy who's just big, strong, and stupid, or maybe not that bright.
Okay.
The slap-happy thief. Okay, that's an archetype that's fairly common. And this last one was always the necromancer trying to take over the world.
I love that.
So... And usually,
answers always do.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, I want to take over the world. Okay, and so, like, for example, in a science fiction game that we were playing, he was like, "Yeah, I'm the guy. He's a robotic scientist, and he's creating this robotic army. Great." And that, but that was his whole thing. It's like, so that's why I asked that. It's like, it's interesting how, you know, because you're right. You know, a wizard isn't necessarily. We always think magic, but it's not necessarily the magic. It's the, I guess. The methodology?
Well, I mean, a wizard is essentially magic. I mean, that's what it is. But in a sci-fi game, there are lots of things that easily substitute for magic.
Right.
If you're changing reality, if you were making the laws of physics your bitch, then you are a wizard.
Okay. Well, we'll put you down for quantum physics.
I also think there's lots of fun stuff with you can do with our old buddy the wizard that's, you know, like, for example, have him or her really go after one of the PCs for a reason that, of course, the PCs have no idea.
Sure.
And then you get a whole adventure, you know, out of just the PCs trying to solve the mystery of why is the evil wizard, you know, chasing me down so specifically.
Yeah.
And who knows where it'll lead, but that can be fun. You don't have to just have him with minions attacking and, you know, doing necromancy on Thursdays. Like, you can give him all these motives that are fun.
Well, come on. He's going to Necromancy Anonymous.
Yeah, well, probably. That's Tuesdays. But
it's true. I mean, you can customize your wizard in lots of ways. If you feel like your wizards are becoming repetitive, then absolutely mix it up. Make your wizard dumb. Like, our wizards have a tendency to be really smart, but most systems have an alternate stat for that. So if you're playing D&D, you know, your wizards always have high intelligence. Great. So let's roll the evil sorcerer this time, very specifically. We'll boost his charisma up. We'll make intelligence his dump stat. And he's going to play really differently. He's not going to scheme. He's going to just destroy.
Yeah.
Or if he is going to scheme, it's going to be socially. It's not going to be like, layers of walls and traps. He's going to like get himself ingrained in the government or something and schmooze, and then he's going to pull like a Mr. Hyde at night and blow some shit up and talk himself his way out of it. You know, like that would be fun.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the things about the Evil Wizard that's interesting is this is one of the situations where role-playing games are probably often ahead of most books, because so many books continue with the cliched supervillain Evil Wizard, who's pretty much the same guy, you know?
Some sort of variation of Ming the Merciless, you mean?
Yeah, well, or Sauron or Melkor or whatever. You know, just the same dude, and he's just nasty, and he has his work-like creatures, and... But in games, there's so many interesting possibilities and player characters to pick on. You know, why let it go that way?
Yeah, because I think you're right, because even if you look from a mythological standpoint, because I consider the Arthurian legends mythological, I mean, you look at Morgan Le Fay, and she doesn't really fit. If you read about how many of those legends, her tactics weren't the same as some of the classical some of the other wizards that you read about in books.
Sure.
Yeah.
So. Wow. The wind has picked up here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Really?
Yeah. It's going to be a little cooler tomorrow, and then by the weekend, it's going to be set for broil. So. Yeah. We're already going to.
All right.
Yeah, we're going to probably, we're not going to be at 100, but we will be seeing near 100 temperatures by the weekend. Just what I wanted to do.
Jeez.
What are you doing this weekend? I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to set out a little solar oven and fry up some meat. So, okay. Well, I think that's all we have for this week. We didn't get any audio comments. Please, we want audio comments. And we've made it easy. We've made it easy for you guys, because now all you have to do is go to the website, click on the little picture that says send us an audio comment, and there's a little other link, and the SpeakPipe application will launch, and you can record an audio snippet. I think you can review it there, so you don't have to worry about sending us a bad comment. You're like, oh, that sounded horrible. You don't have to send it. You can actually review it and then send it, and then that will send it to us, and the audio quality will be much more improved than the 800 number that we used to have. So go ahead and do that. Or if you don't want to do that, you can send us a link at info@rpgcircus.com, or you can send us a comment on our Facebook page. Just, you know, type RPG Circus into the search on Facebook, and you will find our page, because we comment every once in a while on there. And we didn't actually get to to some comments that were actually sent to us, strangely enough, some written comments, because we're kind of at the end. The gentleman that does 1D4 Con sent us some comments about our last episode. But we will get into them next time, because we'll have some more time. So, anything you guys want to say before we go? Are we good?
No, that was a good time, guys.
Good.
All right. Yeah. So, those of you who are just a reminder, those of you who are, speaking of 1D4 Con, if you are in the Virginia area, Winchester, Virginia area, and you're available, go to 1D4 Con. RPG Circus is released under Creative Commons 3.0 U.S. Attribution License. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.